organizers for the invitation. It's nice to be here at Field. Secondly, if you were in Guelph about a month ago or in Barcelona, then I apologize because you're going to hear the same talk again. If you were in Guelph and in Barcelona, then I don't feel bad at all. I mean, you have to take some responsibility for your own actions here if you're going to fall for this twice. I think there's only one person in that category, so maybe zero. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, I could listen to this. Okay. Okay, so this is the outline. You're going to get a short course on hyperbolic dynamical systems, which are called Smale spaces. I'll discuss the construction of C-star algebras. It's not just a cross-product construction. It's a little more complicated. And then I'll talk about, it's not, a lot of this people have heard before. The newer stuff is towards the end, which involves trying to come up with some sort of homology theory for Smale spaces. So this is a definition due to David Ruelle probably more than 30 years ago, I guess now, which is, okay, it's not one of the more all-time popular definitions in dynamical systems. The systems themselves are of interest, but this definition, it's a little bit technical, and there's some not terribly nice features about it. And in fact, I'm not even going to give you a precise version, so this is a slightly heuristic version. It's a compact metric space which has a homeomorphism with canonical coordinates. Certainly the term canonical coordinates everybody in dynamics knows and loves. And the idea is that if you've got a point in the space and a small number epsilon, you get canonically two subsets parameterized by the point and the small number. S and U stand for stable and unstable in this business. And the idea is that their product is homeomorphic to a neighborhood of the point. And in fact, if you look at Ruelle's definition, which I'm not giving, I mean, there's sort of an explicit map from this product to a neighborhood of the point. So that's where it's a little more concrete. Basically, you should think of this product as this is an epsilon neighborhood of the point. Okay. So this is a system of neighborhoods at the point. The key feature dynamically is that on the S set, you see that the map phi contracts the distances between points, and on the U set, okay, you say expands, and you think expands, but for technical reasons, it's much better to say that the inverse contracts. And there's a phi invariance to this whole thing that I'm not saying. And if you want to summarize, there's one slide there, that's the picture, okay? So these two sets, XS and XU, they intersect exactly at the point X, and the little arrows are meant to represent contracting and expanding features of this dynamical system. These are typical in chaotic systems, okay, if you have homeomorphisms of metric spaces. Okay, now, actually, let's expand on that a little bit more. Where did the definition come from? Well, it came out of Smale's program. Now, what was Smale interested in? He was interested in diffeomorphisms of manifolds, okay? Now, he realized many things. One of the key things is that you should look for you don't want to study all of them because they're too general. You want to study a certain class. So what he asked for is you look at a very specific type of recurrence. I won't say exactly what kind. You look at a certain kind of recurrence, and where you see that recurrence for your dynamics, you should see this kind of product structure. Okay? Now, if you're on a manifold, okay, this is easy because, well, the manifold looks like the tangent space. And what does it say to say the tangent space is a product? Well, it's a direct sum of two subspaces, okay? What does it mean to say contracting and expanding? Well, you just phrase that in terms of the derivative, okay, which makes it all much nicer. Now, the virtue of this definition comes from one of Smale's other great realizations, and that's the fact that where you have this recurrence is not usually a submanifold. It's some kind of fractal object. So the idea here is simply that, look, you're moving out of the topological category anyway, so you should move your definition. You're moving out of the differentiable category, the smooth category, and so you should modify your definition appropriately. Okay, now, we're going to define two equivalence relations, stable and unstable equivalence, by two points are stably equivalent if, as you iterate them, they get closer. That doesn't mean they're converging to anything, but as they move around, the relative distance gets closer and smaller. And unstable equivalence use the inverse of the map. Now, we've used these terms twice on two different slides, so we better relate the two of them. the idea is just that the local S set that I had in the last picture, that's part of this equivalence class, okay? And it's basically just this contracting business, well, together with the invariants that I didn't tell you, so that you can get an estimate like this and iterate it, and you actually see a geometric rate of contraction, okay, for the points in that local S set. However, the global structure is much more complicated, okay? In other words, these equivalence classes as whole things are much, much more complicated than these local sets are, and that's kind of somehow the subtlety of the whole subject. So, let me give you the first example. Oh, just from the examples. Okay. And I mean, the first example is supposed to illustrate that. Okay, so you take, this is the most famous matrix in dynamical systems. You'll notice its determinant is minus 1. And initially, you can simply think of it as an automorphism of the plane. Okay? Think of the plane, and this is an automorphism of it, as a linear map. It has two eigenvalues. One of them is bigger than 1. The other one, well, the other one's negative, but less than 1 in absolute value. And on those eigendirections, that's where you see contracting and expanding. So if I drew the plane, well, I'll keep this example around for a while. So you see an eigenspace. Let's do this one. So there's one of the two eigenspaces. This one is actually where you see contracting. And the other eigenspace is where you see expanding. Okay. Now, actually, what I've shown you is the contracting and expanding at this point because it's a fixed point and it's somehow easier, but you can move the picture around, essentially. Now, of course, this isn't, well, first of all, it's not a very complicated dynamical system. The other thing that's obviously not so good about it is the plane isn't compact. But this matrix has determinant minus 1, so it maps the integer lattice to itself, and so you can simply mod out by the integer lattice and get a map on the torus instead. And, well, okay, locally it's exactly the same because the plane locally looks like the torus. So there's no, I haven't changed anything. But now the structure of these things is much more complicated. Well, the local structure isn't. That was, hey, George's question. But this line here, if you take this line, it has an irrational slope. And if you push it down to the torus, it's winding densely. And that's one of these equivalence classes. So here, these things are lines winding densely, whereas these are relatively simple. Okay. Maybe I'll mention this one, just I'll do this one very quickly. Okay. The solenoid, okay, well, there's a class of these, I just picked one of them. So you look at infinite sequences in the circle where the square of entry n plus 1 is entry n, okay, and the map is to simply square all the entries, okay, and that's for this space a homeomorphism. Now, there's a map down to the ordinary torus that simply picks off the zeroth entry, and it's pretty easy to see the pre-image of a point as a Cantor set, because, well, once I tell you what you have to put in for z0, for z1, you've got a choice of square roots, and you just keep choosing square roots all the way out, and that's a Cantor set. In fact, if you took a little open interval in the circle, the pre-image looks like the interval across the Cantor set, okay? And that, actually, is the expanding direction, and this is the contracting direction. This is expanding really just because the squaring map on the circle expands, and the other one, well, you can think about that, okay? Now, this is a nice example because here we have Euclidean space cross Cantor set as opposed to this example, which was Euclidean cross Euclidean. Okay, I don't need to keep this one up that much. I'll mention two others without saying almost anything about them. Substitution, there's certain classes of substitution tilings like the Penrose tiling. We'll give you examples of these things. The map there is the substitution map. And the other one that's in some sense the most important is the basic sets for axiom A systems. So this is part of Smale's program, okay? These are sort of fundamental either chaotic dynamical systems that are of real, serious, and important interest. Okay. Now, this brings us to example zero, okay? It's example zero for a few reasons, okay, which are the shifts of finite type, okay? So you start here with a finite-directed graph. So zero, G0 is the edges, G1 is the vertices, I and T stands for initial and terminal, and you simply look at doubly infinite sequences in the graph, okay? And the map, the dynamical system, is simply shifting the sequence one unit to the left. Just move everything over. Okay. Now, these are fairly simple, fairly common dynamical systems, but let's just see. I mean, why do you have this local product structure that I talked about? I mean, this is not a system that you really want to draw a picture of. I mean, it's just not helpful, right? I mean, just they, for instance, all look like each other. But here's what you do. If you take a doubly infinite sequence E, okay, I put the epsilon equal to 1, but since I haven't told you what the metric is here, it doesn't really matter what I put the epsilon equal to. So what is the local state, the local contracting set? You look at all sequences that have the E in the right, and anything you like, the stars just mean you put anything you like, okay? And for U's, they go obviously in the other direction. Okay, now, first of all, why is the product of these two things homeomorphic to a neighborhood? Okay, well, fortunately, in this era of cutting and pasting, it takes very little imagination to see how to do that, right? So you paste the left tail of this with the right tail of this with the left tail of that, and you've got a typical point in the neighborhood. So that's the canonical coordinates. Why do you see contracting expanding? Well, again, now I haven't told you what the metric is, but I want you to imagine a metric in your mind, how to measure distances between these sequences, okay? So imagine that. Take two points that both look like this, okay, and measure the distance between them with your metric that you just imagined. Now move them both over one and do it again. Well, hopefully, if you've done something clever, the number just got smaller, right? So you actually have to be a little bit careful with how you do that, but you can think a little bit more on that if you like. So that's the contracting, and of course, shifting the other one the other way gives you the expanding direction. Okay, so this is a sort of a fundamental example in a certain sense. Here are two senses in which it's the fundamental example. First of all, these are exactly, up to topological conjugacy, isomorphism, these are exactly the zero-dimensional examples. So if you have a totally disconnected dynamical system with these properties, it looks like one of these for some graph. The other thing is Bowen's result, which is really the fundamental step in the subject in certain many ways, and we'll come back to this. Don't worry what the word irreducible means. It's minor technicality. Let's not worry about it. But it says every irreducible Smail space is the image of one of these under a map. Well, it's continuous, equivariant for the dynamics, and actually finite to one. Okay, it's actually a one-to-one on a dense G delta. So it's as close to an isomorphism as you could possibly hope. So in a certain sense, this means this class is really very fundamental for the subject. Okay. So let's go on to the C-star algebras. Okay. To make the C-star algebras, you should start by picking a set of periodic points. And now, essentially, the set of periodic points is not going to matter in the end, okay, if with very minor conditions on it. So you can pick all of them if you want. There always are some, I should say. And in fact, I don't really want a set of periodic points. I want if I got a point, I want its whole orbit. So take its whole orbit. In this example here, you should just take the origin and nothing else. That's a nice fixed point. Okay, so just use that one. Now, what I want to look at, I should cover up part of this for a second, is I want to look at its unstable equivalence class just for a second. Okay. Now, in this picture, that's the red line. It's winding densely around in the torus. Now, as a subset of the torus, that's a disaster. Okay, it's not locally compact. It's just it's a bad set. Okay, however, if we take all these little sets, part of our definition, these local contracting sets, they're parameterized by the points, not just the x here, but any point on this line, any epsilon, they form a neighborhood base for topology. It's a new topology. It's different from the topology it gets as a subset of X. And it makes this thing a line, which is plainly what it's supposed to be anyways, right? So with this new topology, this red line really is a line. It's locally compact. It's much better. And that works generally, okay? Now, we now take stable equivalence, okay, the idea of two points getting closer together, and we look at that relation on this line with the new topology, okay? In other words, if I was to start at this point here and follow along the other line, which of course goes up here, comes down, those two points are equivalent to each other, okay? They're stably equivalent. Well, okay, look at that equivalence relation. They now, you now actually have countable equivalence classes, and so you look at that equivalence relation on this one line. Okay, we call that at C-star algebra, the C-star algebra equivalence relation S X C P. There's another one where instead of looking at, okay, so I would instead look at the stable class of my point in P and unstable equivalence on it, and that's the second algebra U. If you're not familiar with C-star algebra equivalence relations or groupoids, I'll actually give another construct. I'll talk about some operators in a minute so you can see it a little more concretely. So there's two C-star algebras. There's two more, and these come about because, okay, if you look at this set here, this set is clearly invariant under the map phi. In fact, phi is a homeomorphism, even with this new topology. Secondly, if two points are stably equivalent, you apply phi to both. Remember, stable equivalence meant as you iterate phi, they get closer. Well, if two points are equivalent, you do phi to both, they're still going to do that. So phi cross phi is an automorphism of the equivalence relation. It gives you an automorphism of these algebras. Okay, and so you can then take the cross product, thinking of this as now an integer action on that C-star algebra. You can do the other one as well. So we call these RS and RU. Okay. Now. Okay. I did want to. I said I wanted to give you some operators. So here's some operators for you. Okay, just in case you. Because I'm going to use this later, anyways. Okay. First of all, let's take a countable set. So, I want to take points from my periodic set of periodic points. I want to look at where their stable classes meet their unstable classes. And this example is enough. I mean, I've only got one point P, okay, to worry about. But what I want to look at is where the red line and the green line meet each other. Okay? Well, that happens in the torus. It's actually a dense subset of the torus. That will be true generally. And I'll take the Hilbert space of square summable sequences over that set. Okay, so there's a natural basis for that, which is simply indexed by the points of that set. And since everything is invariant under phi, I can define phi permutes the set, so that gives me a unitary operator. Okay, so I got, first of all, a unitary operator on this Hilbert space. And now I want to construct some other operators. Okay, I need a little bit of data. I need a pair in the EU set, but the Y point should be in the local stable set of the X point. Let me put the picture. The picture is a lot better than the formula, so let's try the picture. Here's my picture. I pick an X and a Y. The point is this Y is in the same contracting local contracting set as the X. So when if you draw the coordinates at X, expanding and contracting coordinates, the Y is on the contracting one. Okay. Now, when you have this situation, there's a natural map from this XU of X to the XU of Y, where you simply pick a point Z and move it horizontally. Okay? Well, of course, this involves writing down Ruelle's rigorous definition of how these things, the coordinates work. But you're just basically moving points from this expanding set at X to the expanding set of Y. Now, I also need, as part of my data, a function here. So I'm taking a continuous function of compact support just on the vertical set through X. So imagine having some function defined on that vertical line. Okay? And I now define an operator from that data. What does it do to one of our basis vectors? Well, if the Z lies on this line, it multiplies by the value of the function and then moves the basis vector over to this set over here. If the z's not on that line, it just gives it value 0. Okay. Now, if you're working in the case where, you know, things are disconnected, this function here you can usually choose as a characteristic function. Okay, if like for a shift of finite type, and then these things are all partial isometries, right? I mean, the number here is 1. So it's either preserves the length of the vector or it sends it to 0. And if you do that, okay, it's a little bit of work, but you take all the operators you can construct this way, not just the one that I've done, but imagine all the possible choices of the data that I had here, conjugate them by the powers of the unitary, take the closed linear span, and that's the S algebra. So you can actually see it geometrically as operators on your space. And the R, since it's the cross product of this by the integer action, just ends up being that. The U is really the unitary that it's implementing the action. Okay? Okay. Well, if we want to analyze this thing, I mean, the first case we got to think about is shifts of finite type. And this was really worked out by Wolfgang Krieger completely. So take a finite directed graph. Think about the shift of finite type, the zero-dimensional one. Now, I'm not going to go into details, but essentially the things you have going for you are two things. First of all, the spaces you're looking at are all totally disconnected spaces. And so it's easier to just, I mean, continuous functions are characteristic functions, right? I mean, you can use spans of characteristic functions. And stable equivalence, we saw on the slide, I mean, it's equality from some point over. Well, that, you keep moving the point where equality happens, and you can write this as a union of equivalence relations, and that makes everything nicer. And you can completely, explicitly, inside the S algebra, produce a sequence of finite dimensional subalgebras whose union is dense. Okay? So these are all AF algebras. Okay? Similarly, the U algebra is also, in this case, an AF algebra. Okay? So for shifts of finite type, S and U are AF algebras. Okay, completely explicitly. If you have a finite, so if you want, if it's an AF algebra, we better know what its K theory is. If you let n be just the number of vertices, there's a matrix called the adjacency matrix, which describes how many edges are there from any vertex to any other vertex. And the K theory of these algebras is just computed as a direct limit. I mean, it comes right out of the statement down there with the finite dimensional subalgebras. Okay. So, in one case, for the S algebra, you use the matrix A transpose. For the U algebra, you use the matrix A. Okay. And if you now look at the R algebras, where you take cross products by the integers, you actually get the Kunz-Krieger algebras for that adjacency matrix A. Okay. Well, tensor the compact. Okay. So far, so good. Now, okay, what's true in general? So, this is quite a few years ago. Jack Spielberg and I proved that, well, okay, again, there's this hypothesis that irreducible, but which I don't want to really define. First of all, the S and U algebras are always, I didn't say U here, but it's true for the U's as well. They're amenable. They have densely defined faithful traces, and the traces are scaled by the automorphisms. And the algebra is simple if and only if X phi is mixing. I don't want to say what mixing is. It's not very hard. But I just wanted to say, you know, there's a nice dynamical criteria for when this is simple. And the R algebras are also amenable. And they're also purely infinite and simple, always for reducible ones. Okay. So these properties from the from the AFs and Kunz-Kriegers generalize this to the general setting. Okay. Now, I need to say a word or two about functoriality, because this construction, I mean, it's a little bit of a funny construction, the way we've built these algebras. And the functoriality goes in the following way. I have to start with this. Let's cover up the bottom part of this again. Okay. Okay. So we're thinking about maps between Snell spaces, and we say one of these maps is strongly U-resolving, okay, if whenever you look at a point y and it's expanding equivalence class, if you like, it's unstable equivalence class. Now, it's sort of clear just from the definitions. This unstable equivalence class will always map into the unstable equivalence class of the point below. But we would actually like that to be a bijection. And it's actually the one-to-one that's the subtle part of this. And if you have one-to-one, it actually means that your map is actually going to be a homeomorphism on these local unstable sets. Okay? So when you see a rectangle in the big space, it's going to map to a rectangle in the small space, but in one of the two directions, the expanding one, it's actually a homeomorphism. So there may be some collapsing going on in the other direction, but in the one direction, it's a homeomorphism. And if you have such a map, then you induce star homomorphisms at the levels of the C-star algebra. I'm not going to explain why. It would take a little while, but not, I mean, it take a little while, but I mean, it's not too difficult. The point that's interesting is, of course, they go in opposite directions, right, depending on which of the two algebras you're building. And, of course, it also means that if instead of having a U-resolving map, you had an S-resolving map, then for the F algebras, your functor would go the other way, okay? So, the functoriality is a little bit sort of subtle for these things, okay? Okay. Now, sort of the, somehow the... Oh, okay. Now, I want to go back if you... Oh, where did I... Remember... Actually, I should have said this at the time, so let me just pull this back a little bit here. I wanted to remind you of when I built these things as operators on a Hilbert space. So this is our construction of these operators on a Hilbert space. If you... Well, I just did S, actually. I didn't really do U. The point is somehow the following. Down until right here, okay, everything's the same whether you're doing S or U. Now, first of all, that means it's the same Hilbert space. It's still the same space L2 of HP, whether I want to describe the S algebra or whether I want to describe the U algebra. And the RS and the RU also end up all operating on the same Hilbert space, okay? And the unitary U that's implementing things is also still on the same Hilbert space. So we actually have all our algebras all represented on the same Hilbert space, okay? And we have the following sort of intriguing little lemma that if you take something from the S algebra and something from the U algebra, first of all, if you take their product, you get a compact operator. Okay. Secondly, they don't actually commute with each other. The S and U algebras are not going to commute, but they do asymptotically. If you apply your automorphism to the element of the S algebra here and here, it starts to commute with the B operator, the other algebra, as n goes to plus infinity. Okay. So two features. First of all, products being compact, and you have kind of an asymptotically commuting thing. Okay, I'm going to give you a proof. Well, okay. Paul Halma said you should always prove something. And I'm going to fall well short of that. But I'm hoping to say something that you can intuitively at least understand a bit of. Okay? What does the S algebra look like? Well, it's the span of these U to the NA, U to the minus N things here. Let's forget the U for a second. Let's just take this operator here. Okay, so let's take this for my A operator, and then I'll take a B from the other algebra, and I'll multiply them. Okay, now actually I'm going to multiply BA times instead of AB, but that's only because we write everything on the wrong side anyway. Okay, so here's our A operator. Okay, what does it do to one of his basis vectors? Well, the only basis vectors that are affected, okay, are the ones that lie on this vertical line. Okay, so that's our S operator. Okay, what does our U operator look like? I didn't show you this, but it's easy. Okay, that's the U operator. Okay, so the operator in U, the B over there, only lives on vectors that are on this horizontal line, and it moves them up to this horizontal line. Okay, so what happens if you multiply these things? What's going to survive? The point has to be on the intersection of a horizontal line and a vertical line. So A times B is rank 1. Okay. Okay, if you want to think about how you get higher ranks, you should think about what happens when you throw the U in here. Okay, and you can, that's a little exercise. Okay, so there's a sort of a sketch of that. If you really want to have fun with this, you should think about, there's actually a proof, geometric proof of this in exactly the same kind of way, which I won't attempt to do. I would take it too far astray. But what this gives you, it's rather interesting. I mean, okay, it's almost like we have a map from S tensor U into the compact. It's not quite because the S and U don't commute. If they commuted, they would actually be a map. But you have asymptotic commuting, okay? Now, asymptotically commuting things, asymptotic morphisms, are defined by Kahn and Higson, okay? And these things, well, define E-theory, and they kind of provide a calculus for K-groups, okay? And what you can build out of this is a duality. So the C star algebras R, S, and R, U, okay, so I'll say in a second why S and U turned into R, S, and R, U. I'll say that in a second. They're K-theoretically dual. Now, what that means, I'm not going to tell you exactly. It really says that there are some KK classes around. But what these KK classes should do is implement isomorphisms between the K-theory, the K-theory of one of the algebras, the K-homology of the other algebra, and vice versa, okay? And it really comes out of this geometric data, okay? Now, oh yeah, why did S and U turn into R, S and R, U? Essentially, it's because the N and the integers here, if you really want an E-theory class, you need an N and the real numbers. And turning this discrete action into a flow, basically you pass from S to R, S. Okay, so I won't say much more about that. One of the nice cute things that comes out of this, if you remember Kunz-Krieger's work of a long time ago, they computed these things for Kunz-Krieger algebras, the K-naught of OA and K1, and they also computed the K-homology. And they're sort of funny formulas because they looked a lot the same, but one of them involved taking the transpose and the other one didn't involve taking the transpose, and this in some sense explains what's happening there. Okay. Now, as I said, the sort of the newer part here, oh, I should say this was, as I mentioned, this is joint work with Jerry Kamenker. We actually had a proof of this about 10 years ago, and one of us who will remain nameless was supposed to write it up, but it was really sort of horrible. And we now have a much nicer proof, okay, which involves some of the ideas here. So hopefully it'll appear fairly soon. Okay. Now, the goal of the last part of the talk is to come start with a Snell space and produce a homology theory. In fact, of course, there's always going to be two of them, so HF and HU. Okay. Now, we're no longer going to see any C-star algebras in the talk, except I'll tell you that the motivation of this whole thing was that these homology theories are supposed to compute the K-theory of the S and U algebras. Okay. And this theorem might not be actually correct, but there's some theorem that is correct that involves K-theory of C-star algebras and the homology. Okay, that's the point. Okay, now the idea is pretty simple. Okay, the idea is to start with dimension groups. Okay, so I defined these dimension groups before, and just in case you understood that, I'm going to change the notation. So start with a finite directed graph. Look at the free abelian group on the vertex set, so formal integral combinations of the vertices. Okay, and you can define a map from this group to itself, an endomorphism of this group. Well, I just have to tell you where to send a generator. Where to send V, you look at all the edges that start at V, take their terminuses, and add them up. And that's another element of this group. So that gives you an endomorphism, and you can make this inductive limit. Okay. Now, I've used new notation, but this is just Z to the number of vertices, and this is just multiplication by the adjacency matrix. Okay. Well, it's either the adjacency matrix or the transpose, and I can never remember which one, so this is one of the reasons I changed the notation. If you reverse the adjacency matrix to the transpose, you get the other dimension group. Okay, but we won't say too much more about that. Okay. Now we remember Rufus Bowen's wonderful theorem. If you have an irreducible Snell space, you can always find a shift of finite type that maps onto it, and with a wonderful map, continuous surjective finite to one. Okay. Now let's take this a little bit further. For every n greater than or equal to zero, okay, I want to look at n plus one tuples. Okay. These things all come out of the shift space, and they all have the same image under this map. Okay? So I just want to figure out where is this map 1 to 1, where is it 2 to 1, where is it 3 to 1, so on. Okay? Encode these sort of sets where it's 1 to 1, 2 to 1, 3 to 1, so on. Now, the remarkable thing is all of these things are shifts of finite type. Okay? In fact, it's very easy to find a graph a graph GN that presents sigma n. Okay, I'm going to left some things under the table for a second, but let me just say roughly the idea of the proof. What is this thing? This is an n plus 1 tuple. It's an n plus 1 tuple of what? It's an n plus 1 tuple of doubly infinite sequences. An n plus 1 tuple of doubly infinite sequences is a doubly infinite sequence of n plus 1 tuples. Okay, those n plus 1 tuples are the edges of this graph. It's not the whole product, but all the edges of this graph can be seen as n plus 1 tuples of edges from the original graph. Okay, so that's the starting point, is Bowen's theorem and this little observation here. And now, you know, you should just really imagine that you're a topologist. I mean, what would a topologist say at this point? Okay? He'd say, look, you have a beautiful theory, okay, that you know completely for shifts of finite type. So anytime you have a shift on some graph, you have a theory, you know what it is. Any object at all that you're interested in can be covered by one of those ones where you know what the theory does. Okay? Not only that, but if you figure out where the theory is 1 to 1, 2 to 1, 3 to 1, and so on, those are also objects where you know what the theory is. Okay, suppose you take a compact manifold. You cover it with balls. Suppose that whenever you intersect a finite number of these balls, you get something that's holomorphic to a ball. Well, then you know what the cohomology is, because you know what the cohomology of all the balls is. There's just a little algebra to compute the cohomology of the whole manifold. Okay, well, that's the idea, but I mean, there's some work to do to see that that all works in this situation, okay? Now, the first little bit of work, okay, is the following. For these systems here, since they're all graphs, I mean, we have these graphs, Gn underlying them, we could take the associated dimension group. It's a little more subtle than that. What I want to do is define this group where I take as generators, well, the vertices of my graph. Okay. Now remember, the vertices consist of n plus 1 tuples of vertices from the original graph. Okay. So it's a little hard to think of, but anyway. And we want to impose the following relations. First of all, a vertex is going to be 0 if a vi and a vj are equal for some I different from j. Okay. And that if you permute these vi's by some alpha, you change your generator only by the sign of the permutation. So somehow we're building in the symmetries of the permutation group acting here. Okay. Now, actually, this is sort of a little bit important because, you know, when you say I want to count here where this is 1 to 1, 2 to 1, 3 to 1, well, of course, you could use all E0 equals E1, E2, E3. I mean, they could make them all the same. Yeah, but then if you do that, the paths are all the same, and this first condition here wipes out the data from that. So that doesn't contribute. And in fact, because the map is only finite to one, only a finite number of these groups are going to be non-zero. I mean, this first relation will wipe out all the groups past some point. Okay? So there's only a finite number of non-zero ones here. Okay, then we can make the inductive systems like this. Okay. And get something that's a little bit like a dimension group. Now, that reminds me I should issue a caution for people who love dimension groups, and there's certainly many of them here. There is no natural way of putting an order structure on this group, and these are not positive maps. Okay, so these are just groups, except when n is 0. Okay. Now, we want to define, of course, what the topologists would say is, I mean, now all you have to understand is how the nth one is related to the n minus first, and the way that you do that if you're a topologist is you have a boundary map. Well, there's sort of an obvious choice for this. The dn group that we just built is an inductive limit of these ones. Dn minus 1 is an inductive limit of these ones. And these are generated by n plus 1 tuples. This is generated by n tuples. And there's an obvious way of getting from n plus 1 tuples to n tuples, right? And it's this sort of standard formula that everybody sees in a topology course. I've changed a little bit usually you put a hat over the one you're deleting. I've decided to say delta n instead. Okay, so you just go through deleting the nth ones, making a boundary map. Now, unfortunately, it's a really nice idea, but it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is, well, okay, it's a fine as a map from here to here, but when you try to make the inductive limits, it's not compatible with the inductive limit structures. Okay. Well, what do you do? Well, you need two ingredients, and the first one is, if you have a formula in mathematics that doesn't work, well, you throw in a parameter, right? So we throw in a parameter, okay, k. Okay, and delta n, instead of delta n there, delta n upper k. What does it do to a vertex? Okay. Now the sum over n is the same one that's there, and the minus 1 to the n is the same as the one that's there. But what do I do instead? I want to, g lower n upper k. That means, I'm looking at gn, which are n plus 1 tuples. I want to look at paths of length k. Okay? So this is paths of length k of n plus 1 tuples. They should start at v, which of course is an n, where is it? It's over here. It's an n plus 1 tuple of vertices. Okay? So you look at the paths of length k starting at that vertex. That's a large set of paths. Dump out the nth entry from each one of them. Now you've got n tuples of paths instead of n plus 1 tuples of paths. Take the terminus of each of those paths, okay, and then sum up over all possible paths. Okay, this will grow exponentially with k, but that's in most cases, but that's okay. Okay, so there's a formula. Okay, k equals 0. K equals 0 is this. Okay, paths of length 0 are just the vertices. Okay, and then you need one other ingredient, and that is, if your map is strongly U-resolving, and remember that means it's one-to-one on the local unstable sets, if it's strongly U-resolving and k is sufficiently large, only depending on pi and x and so on, this map, the gamma n is the map in the inductive limit, this map, delta n k, will start to commute with it and the map in the n minus 1 sequence. And they'll actually coincide with gamma n to the k plus 1. Okay? And what this means is that you can get a well-defined map between the dn gn and the dn minus 1 gn. I haven't really explained this notation. I'm thinking of when you go out in the inductive system, if you take an element of the kth group, you apply this map to it and regard it as the k plus capital kth group in the other system. Okay? And that's a well-defined map between the meshing groups. The next lemma is probably fairly obvious, that it is something you want, and that is the square is 0. So this really is a boundary map. Okay? Okay, now, when I was preparing this, I realized, this lemma is really the heart of this homology theory. Okay? The fact that this lemma works is the heart of everything. And, of course, this lemma is good news and it's bad news. Right? Every statement in mathematics is good news and bad news, right? The good news is called the conclusion, and the bad news is called the hypothesis, right? So we get this wonderful formula. The bad news is I need the map to be strongly U-resolving. And remember where I started this, okay? I started with Bowen's theorem. Oops. So I found a shift that mapped onto the space I was interested in. Now, if this is U resolving, it means the expanding set. The expanding sets here look like the expanding sets here, but here they're totally disconnected. So this isn't going to be a torus, okay, because it doesn't have contracting sets that are totally disconnected. So there's the first sentence. The hypothesis is strong because it requires the unstable sets down in the base to be totally disconnected. Now, ignoring that just for a second, we'll have to come back and deal with it in a second. On the other hand, if you had an S-resolving map instead, you would go back and change your delta, and basically, what you're doing, you interchange the initial and terminal. In other words, take the opposite graph, okay? And you get a very similar lemma, but you've interchanged initial and terminal in your gamma n. Now, that's sort of bad because this inductive limit is not the right group. It's the starred group. Well, you can fix that simply by taking HOM of this thing instead, and that turns this into the other gamma. The main content of this that I want to emphasize is you get a boundary map, but it now increases degree instead of decreasing degree. Okay? Okay. Now, but we're still faced with this problem of the unstable sets being zero-dimensional, so here's what we do instead. Okay, what I want to look for, starting from XV, is a new Smail space YC with a factor map from Y down to X such that the stable sets in Y are totally disconnected, but pi U is strongly U resolving. Okay, now let me just say what is this saying? This says that in the Y space, the S direction should be totally disconnected. This says the U set direction should look like X. Okay, you can think of Bowen's theorem as saying Okay, I can start with any Snell space at all and totally disconnect it. Now what I'm trying to do at the moment is not do that in both directions. I only want to do it in one of the two directions. I want to disconnect the S sets but not affect the U sets. Okay? And if you can do that, that's called Y. Okay? Similarly, you would like to do it the other way around with a space called Z that disconnects the U sets but leaves the S sets alone. And if you have such a thing, okay, we'll call it a resolving pair. Okay? And in fact, for irreducible spaces, these things always exist. Okay? So this is something I proved a number of years ago. Okay, so you can do this. It's an improved version of Bowen's theorem. Why is it an improved version of Bowen's theorem? Well, if you get to that stage, let's cover up that, you do a fibered product, meaning sigma just consists of a pair from Y, one from Y, one from Z, that have the same image. And that is then a shift of finite type. Okay? So you're getting a better version of Bowen's theorem. Okay? You've got a shift of finite type mapping down, but it maps down in nice ways. Now what do you do? Well, what did we do before? We decided to look at this map and say, where is it 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1, and so on. I'm going to do that again, but I've got a two-variable problem. So for every L and M greater than or equal to 0, I want L plus 1 things from Y and M plus 1 things from Z, all having the same image down below. Okay? Okay, now, all of these things, for every L and M, these are all shifts of finite type. Okay? In fact, the graphs, now things get really complicated because the graphs are no longer n-tuples of graphs. They're now L plus 1 by M plus 1 tuples of edges and vertices. Okay, things are also complicated by the fact that the group that's acting the symmetries now are the SL, it's the permutations SL plus 1 cross SM plus 1, and you have to build that in. Okay, let's not go into very many details here. At the end of the day, you end up with a double complex. Okay, so for every L and M greater than or equal to 0, you get a group. And you get boundary maps. It's based on, essentially all the work has been done in the earlier case. You'll notice that horizontally they go down and vertically they go up, and that's because one of the maps is U resolving, the other one's S resolving. Okay, and now you build with this double complex, you get an ordinary complex by, you identify the groups that lie on a diagonal, well, identify them, take the direct sums. So direct sum all the along the diagonals, and you have a boundary map that goes from one of these diagonals to the next one, and you take the homology of that complex. Okay. So let me try to give you a couple of results that maybe suggest it's worth doing all this trouble. Okay. First of all, the answer, just like open covers of manifolds, the groups you compute by this don't depend on the choice of the resolving pair. Remember, the data for this was to start with an X phi, and I found a Y that disconnected the unstable sets, or stable sets, a Z that disconnected the unstable sets, and I pulled back to a sigma. Okay, the choices I made here don't enter into the ultimate computation. What you get in the end only depends on the thing you're studying, the X phi at the beginning. Secondly, okay, this is maybe not so inconceivable at this point with the functoriality of these constructions. Okay. And, oh dear, am I missing a slide? Oh, thank you. That would have been a real disaster. Okay. Oh, I see. I'm just getting blown away here. Okay. Now, if you look at the map phi, okay, you can think of the map phi as a map from X to itself, okay? So it induces, it's SMU resolving, it actually induces automorphisms of all these invariants, okay? Now, if you take, okay, so take a number bigger than or equal to 1. The map phi induces a map from this group to itself, okay? Instead of these groups, I would rather have rational vector spaces, so I tensor on the rational numbers. These are finite dimensional. There's only a finite number of them non-zero for different n's. Take phi star to the power p, take the trace of these maps, add up with a minus 1 to the n thrown in. There's only a finite number of non-zero things. And you will compute, you will count the number of fixed points for the map phi to the p. okay? So it actually provides a Lefschetz, kind of a Lefschetz formula. And this was sort of a question raised a long time ago of try to find a homology theory for these basic sets in Snail's program that would give you a Lefschetz formula. Maybe I'll just finish with this. There's very few examples I can compute. Oh, if you start with a shift of finite type for this thing, you get, in n equals 0, you get the original dimension group for the shift, and all the other groups are 0. Okay? And there's one other one that I can do, and I'll just mention this. Okay? So the famous matrix in dynamics, the automorphism of the two torus that I have up there, it turns out that H minus 1 is Z, H0 is Z squared, H1 is Z, okay? And now, oh, and all the other ones are 0. Okay? And that should look a little bit suspicious, okay? Because it looks like the cohomology of the torus. Well, okay, as in this theorem, the original map gives you an automorphism of these groups. The automorphism here is 1. The automorphism here is 1, 1, 1, 0. And the automorphism here is minus 1, which also looks like the action of that matrix on the cohomology of the two torus. But there is a dimension shift, right? I mean, there's a dimension shift. And I mean, I don't know exactly why this is true. Well, I mean, I know the computation's true. Why it should turn out to be the cohomology, I don't know. Okay, so, thank you.